The Tigers are premiers for the 12th time in their history. Rioli, this time, 4, 3, 2, 1, it's a goal. One of the Tigers. Whoa, what about that? A 4-3-60 in slow motion. Just down your marks.
Oh, gee, yes.
He's had four shots on goal, and that was his worst.
Big man takes the mark, it's all too much for Leon.
Well, he's an accurate set shot, the big fella. 4 out of 5 so far this year.
Make it 5 out of 6. The skipper goes and goes, and then tries to lace it out, but no, he doesn't. He kicks a goal. How sweet it is, eh?
Pickett lines up.
Going off everywhere at the moment. Pickett's having an influence in his first game of footy.
Started with him.
Yep. Dusty's dangerous. The swarming pressure is overwhelming.
Didn't want the body contact. He kept the body free. The pickup's unbelievable. That's a play of the game. That is the play of the game.
We underestimate the footy brain in Dustin Martin. You look at his physical ability. That champion data would tell us 7 out of the last 9 finals you can make the case for being best on ground.
I think they were a better team last year than they are now.
And welcome back to Richmond Tiger Talk. My name's Nick.
And I'm Andrew.
And it's a special episode. We've got another interview. There's another Richmond book coming out. Later in the show, we've got Waleed Ali joining us to talk about his great new book that he's authored with Basha Hooley, called Faith, Family and Football. But first I thought we should cover off on all the other football news that's going on, Andy.
Yes, there is quite a lot going on, and things move quickly in trade period. So you'll have to forgive us if our hot takes are somewhat more tepid by the time you listen. But there's a bit going on, and before we get to Waleed, who will join us on the pod shortly, I guess the hottest issue is Jack Higgins right now.
Yeah. So it's Wednesday night. The one trade that we've done was Oleg Markov to the Suns for a future third round pick, which, yeah, we talked about when we were previewing trade period. You know, it there's a certain degree of heavy heart associated with seeing Oleg go, but again, it's someone who wasn't getting a regular senior game. He's been at the club 5 years. I don't think he certainly doesn't go with any ill will.
No, and you know, to speak it, put it in very crude terms for the, which will lead into the Jack Higgins issue. We actually have zero leverage with an out of contract player because he could just go into the preseason draft, and he's almost certainly not going to get picked up by anyone by the Suns. So getting a third round pick, which if the Suns are mediocre again next year, is not nothing. Like, it's not that far from nothing, but still not nothing. That has some value, and the draft next year is better. So look, it's disappointing, and we'll miss him, and we're losing part of our depth which was valuable this year. But yeah, you've got to draw the line somewhere, and as we discussed last pod, there's no magic solution to the depth chart that gives him senior games next year.
No, you can't. You know, he's in his mid-20s. You certainly can't blame him for getting a multi-year contract when it's on offered. A situation that is a bit different is the Jack Higgins one. He's still under contract for 2021, and instead his manager, well, through his manager, he's requested a trade to St Kilda. So I think whereas there's been a fair bit of goodwill towards guys like Sammy Lloyd, even Dan Butler, in helping them find a club when they're out of contract and looking for new opportunities, this isn't that situation.
No, he's in contract, and wasn't on the first page of the plans, but he was definitely quite high up on the second page of plans for next year. I would have described him as a key depth player.
Yeah, he's a top 20 draft pick 3 years ago, and has played some good senior football for us. I think, you know, and there's haggling going on about what sort of draft compensation we'll get from the Saints. But yeah, it's not going to be a future third round draft pick. It'll be something more substantial to that. How do you feel about the idea of Higgins in a St Kilda jumper?
Well, I mean, it's sort of gone further than that already. We've already knocked back a second round pick, so we've shown our hands in the negotiating. I've had multiple takes on this. I had the take last week that I could see why he's more valuable somewhere else. But sort of other Richmond fans got into my head a bit about this. Sort of, and also the club apparently is quite angry behind the scenes. Is, you know, we've given away enough good players on relatively low return, and we're going to play hardball on this one, which actually I don't mind because I'm quite happy to keep him. So we've knocked back the second round pick. So, you know, that's the baseline, Nick. If Dan Richardson decides that he's retiring says this guy Nick Cumston should be general manager of Richmond. Dan Richardson. I think Dan Richardson's got plenty of time on his hands. Blair Hartley. If Blair Hartley suddenly retires and you're doing his job, what's enough for you to say yes?
Look, the rumor is future second and third round draft picks, but I'd actually rather get into the business of swapping first round picks either this year or next, if not both, and yeah, sort of work and a second round draft pick. I think then you're starting to put together something useful.
So if trade deadline's 5 minutes to go and the Saints are offering the second and third next year, do you take it?
Probably so, although it's starting to be quite a lot of draft picks, and you know, it may be another...
Shorter list.
And it may be, yeah, a shorter list. So, you know, how much it remains to be seen how much use that is, although it is often the case that teams that have academy players... looking to trade down, but it's useful without changing my world.
Yeah, and the academy picks might not be in operation for much longer. So
no, they've announced that from next year, everyone except the Northern academies, which have traditionally been extremely lucrative for particularly GWS, but this year the Suns have some good picks. Next year, the Victoria, all the traditional football states won't be able to have top 20 picks from their academies. They won't be able to match bids, and the year after it's top 40 picks. So it's gone, which I think is a good change from, you know, getting guys who would have been picked up anyway, to actually more the Derek Eglamazy Smith types who get a chance at AFL than they otherwise wouldn't. Other bit of news I wanted to mention, well, you know, it's not often that people come on our podcast and straight out lie to us, but that's clearly what Conrad Marshall has done, and I'm more than happy to forgive him for it, because I'm excited that we're getting another book about another premiership.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it.
About the book, still wounded by the loss of faith and trust.
True. My poor sound editing actually gets, I've seen an early proof of the book that my poor sound editing gets a serve. So I'm sort of, I'm on the back foot. I'm a bit defensive. I can't lie. But no, it's great. Yeah, so it's great news that Con's writing another book and that they really have become synonymous with the Christmas time reading. I'm looking forward to sitting down on a beach, I think, like all the last books and reading the last two books and reading them quietly. So congrats to Con and congrats to, I think it's Slattery Media who publishes it. Yep. So that's exciting.
Yeah. Another bit of news, Ryan Ferguson was appointed our AFLW coach. And I have to say, I didn't love this one. He's been a very well-respected member of the coaching staff with the AFL program and the VFL program as a development coach and as a backline coach with the VFL. But he beat out a former AFLW premiership coach in Beck Goddard, and it did feel like a recruitment process where they started with the ending, so to speak, in terms of the outcome they wanted.
Yeah, true. But, you know, you don't know. You weren't on the panel, and sort of there might be a devil you know aspect to the coaching staff. Look, it's so hard to tell, isn't it, with these coaching hires?
It is hard to tell, but
is this a little bit of because there's been a few things that happened in the past, the things that make you go that you're less willing to give a benefit of the doubt now?
Look, it is
because that's totally how I think. Like, I'm not saying I think that way. Like, I could completely understand that rationale way of thinking about it.
Look, I know the club has been really concerned about the damage done. You know, losing a lot of good people, and this is a way to keep one of those good people, and I completely understand that. But I can also see the argument that it's difficult to say that on merit he's a more deserving candidate.
Yeah. Well, I don't know enough about Beck Goddard, and the question is, why is she not at original club?
Well, the rumour is she's a pretty big personality and not all that easy to deal with, but she's also very successful. I mean, she already has a current assistant coaching job, so she was only taking a senior coaching job. But yeah, there is a there's a tension there from with the cutbacks, a lot of clubs are sort of doubling up on their AFLW position. And I can see why that's annoyed some people.
Okay. And joining us now is Melbourne media personality. I can't actually name the amount of media shows that he's now on when I did some research on him. Waleed Ali, and more importantly, famous Richmond fan and co-author of the new Bashir Hooley book, Faith, Family and Football. Welcome to the pod, Waleed.
Oh, thank you very much for that introduction. I'm just trying to figure out all the shows that you might be referring to. It's
cool. Well, I started with your podcast, Insiders, the project. You know, there's a lot to refer to, and the Good Weekend podcast.
Oh, well, yeah. So my theory, you've basically included anywhere I've ever made an appearance. That's very generous of you. My theory is if you do enough things badly, you end up with quite a CV or a bio at least. So thank you.
Well, you are in some ways, and actually this comes a question I wanted to ask you. Is you sort of in some ways become one of the spokespeople of the Tiger Army. And and as a public figure, do you ever get frustrated that sometimes you just, at a game that you sort of, when we went to games, that you have to watch what you say as a fan a bit more, that you have to be perhaps a bit more positive than you would be otherwise?
Do you know what? I would if it weren't for the fact that as a fan I'm actually quite insular. So you know there are different styles of watching the footy.
Yeah, yeah.
My style is to be—I send a lot of it inward, like I implode rather than explode.
Mm.
And if I'm with someone at the footy, like often my brother, because his reserve seat's next to mine, or I've got a mate who has a reserve seat in the same area, who I often go with, and I'll discuss it, but not in a way that'll be overheard by the, not deliberately, but that's just my mode. I'm not the person who stands up and screams out, "You're white maggot," but that's not me. So I'm kind of well adapted to this sort of situation, but I understand the conundrum you're pointing to.
Yeah.
But as someone who has, you know, ways you can get your message out there, and do you ever just feel like, in your media career, you've done some great sprays. Do you ever just feel like looking down the barrel of a camera on one of your outlets and saying, "My fellow Australians, I want to talk to you about Patrick Dangerfield staging," or something like that? Surely that must be tempting.
Yeah. But the problem is, I know what will happen, and that is my producers will say, "Make it national, make it national." And then I'll have to work in an NRL reference just for balance, even if it doesn't fit. Yeah, I do know what you mean. Do you know what I do get? I do get that frustration of seeing, you know, and I think fans of every team would have this, because the weird thing about being a footy fan, or really any sports fan, is you usually are more expert on your team than the experts are, because they have to be across all the other teams, right? So they're more expert than you on the game, but you're more expert on, you know, so you'll hear people go, "Wow, where did Jaden Short come from?" And it's like, "Oh my God, where have you been? Like, this probably wasn't even his best season. Like, what are you talking about?" You know, it's that kind of thing. So I do get that feeling sometimes where I feel like, God, there's this gaping hole in this discussion. Why is nobody filling that? Why is nobody saying something that's really obvious? And so, yeah, I do have those moments where I really want to do that. In fact, it happened recently, and I didn't have a camera to shout down, so I had to turn it into a written piece. But, you know, that's my other, perhaps more couth outlook. Wow, that.
Now, I wanted, you did a podcast recently with media tart Conrad Marshall, and, which was excellent, and well done for getting a word in with him.
Although getting a word in with George Megalogenis, you know, God bless him, because we interviewed him a couple of years ago. That's quite an effort as well.
Oh, he's got a lot of good things to say is the problem.
He does.
So whenever you jump in, I feel like you just might be lowering the tone a little bit.
I know. And his book is great. Like, we are in a golden era of Richmond books.
Yes. There's a Richmond intelligentsia that's kind of emerging, I think, which is...
Yes, nicely said. Yes, sort of the chattering class of Richmond.
Reflecting of the suburb in many ways.
Yes, yes, that's true. I'm recording this from Fitzroy, so I'm sort of intellectually a fellow traveller. Now, yes. I wanted to ask you, in that Good Weekend podcast, you said something that I really related to, was your first football memory was 1983, which I started barracking for Richmond in 1983. So I really related to that, that you got on board just in time to experience all 37 years of misery. but what I wanted to ask you is, where did it turn? What was the moment where you fell in love with Richmond?
Actually, I can't answer that, because I don't remember not being in love with Richmond. It's really interesting, right? So there are very few things in my life like that. I remember going to kinder. I remember the day I learned to tie my shoes. So I remember life before being able to tie shoelaces. Just about every aspect of my life seems to have a beginning, whereas this just seems to be something that has just always been part of me, and it's been in the water or something. So I never made a conscious decision to support Richmond that I can recall, and I have no memory of discovering Richmond. I don't even have a memory of being told I was a Richmond supporter, which must have happened at some point, right? It must have. Because my brother's the reason I'm a Richmond supporter. He's 10 years older than me, so he's very influential in my life, obviously. But I don't remember the chat, you know, where he sat me down and he said, "Now, there are a lot of teams out there and this is the right team." I don't remember that. It just sort of happened. So I cannot actually conceive of my life absent Richmond. It doesn't exist. I have vivid memories of like key moments in it. So, you know, those snapshots of games from sort of the mid 80s, so maybe 85, 86, where I went to the MCG, and that sort of, I was just sort of taken aback by the vividness of those games and the fact that there were Richmond players right in front of me and seeing the jumpers, and they had a particularly rich kind of yellow, it was closer to an orange back in those days with the sash. And, you know, when I was a kid and you'd pay attention to who the sponsor was on the jumper and you'd really remember that. And then you'd see a photo from previous year and you were blown away that there was a different sponsor previously. Like, so I'm an Esso Richmond fan. Like that's my era. So all these things are really vivid. There are vivid moments, but there is no beginning to it in my life. It's actually really strange in that way. Mm.
You mentioned in your interview with Con, Maurice Rioli being one of your sort of early heroes. There's a good chance we draft Maurice Rioli Jr. this year. How will that hit emotionally?
Yeah, that would really be fantastic if that happened. I remember seeing, weirdly, this will seem random. There was a game, a Richmond Essendon game mid-2000s probably, where Peter Costello, who I think was still in politics at the time and is, of course, famously an Essendon supporter, made the observation that he felt really old because he'd watched the Richmond Essendon game and Job Watson had tackled Andrew Raines. And he said, like, what a moment that was to see Watson and Raines on the field again like this. And I feel it would be a little bit like that. He might actually be the first father-son, sort of Gary Ablett aside. Well, it's not father-son, but you know what I mean, to land in my football supporting life. Like, have Richmond had any others? That, like, I missed Richo, I missed Bowden. Like, I got the kids. I didn't get the
Patrick Nash.
The parents. Yes, that's not a bad one. Yeah, Patrick Nash, true. Because Chris Nash was a big part of my life as well, because 95 was the greatest year ever for me until 2017. But even then, Patrick Nash has played, what, two games? Three, maybe?
Three.
And plays on the back line too. I don't quite get the flashbacks.
Yeah.
Right.
No, he needs to be a bit chunkier in the thighs.
Yeah, that's probably right. But I think the reality thing, yeah, especially because he's just such a like symbolic and emblematic figure in Richmond history, Maurice. From everything, the Norm Smith in the losing grand final, all of that, I think, just, yeah.
Yeah. Now,
Waleed, I wanted to ask you, you wrote an excellent piece in The Age about the Richmond dynasty and what defines it. But before we get into that, I just want you've correctly rated the premierships 17, 20, 19 as far as emotional impact. And I think that's reasonably widely felt.
Accepted canon, yeah.
Yeah. What about your favourite finals? In 17, there's a big debate between the GWS and the Geelong final, or, you know, whatever final you can pick. What meant the most to you?
So I think it depends a little bit on how precisely you want to ask the question. So if you ask my greatest ever day at the footy, that for me is prelim final 2017. And there's just no doubt about that in my mind. And the reason for that is that, A, we're finally in a grand final and I never thought I would see that. But, B, it can never be replicated. Like, you think about it, it's 94, nearly 95,000 fans. We had the place to ourselves. It was like the world's biggest Premier League ground or something. It was extraordinary. And you had the drought. You had that sort of the hunger of the Tiger Army that has been, I think, the loudest football supporter base in my lifetime, just because of the desperation. So you had the build-up of all that desperation given full-throated expression at the MCG with utter dominance because GWS didn't have anyone there. We will never see anything like that again, ever. Like, the only way that could happen is that we go on another 40-year drought and a new team is introduced in the competition that has no fans just on the eve of us breaking that drought. That's the only way that could happen, and no other club could do it, because even if they have the supporter base like Collingwood do or something like that, they don't have the desperation that we had in that moment. They don't have the
hunger.
Yeah, and it's not just that we hadn't made a grand final. We'd been hopeless. Like, there was that famous stat that Fitzroy had won more finals than Richmond until that 2017 series between 1983 and 2017 or whatever it was, right? Like, that's how bad we had been. And grand finals were a thing that just happened to other people. This was not a I didn't even contemplate that I would ever see Richmond in, like ever see Richmond in a grand final. So all those factors coming together make that just irreplicable. And it's, for me, it's the greatest day at the footy. Even, and I'm so, not saying this with the benefit of three premierships, because even the week after we won the grand final, that was my view, that the preliminary final was my greatest ever day at the footy, because I thought, you know what? It's conceivable we play another grand final, and it's conceivable that what happened against Adelaide happens again, and it will feel roughly the same, but nothing will ever feel like that prelim final. Like, it just can't. And I would argue no other supporter base in the country has had a moment like that.
It's hard to find, maybe in the NRL, but certainly not in the AFL.
So maybe you could say South Sydney.
If you have a third as many people, it might be the NRL.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, yeah, so the South story is really, you know, leaving the competition and coming back and winning it. That's pretty good.
That's pretty good, yeah.
And in a city club with sort of a traditional rusted-on supporter base.
But you don't get the scale of it and you don't get the desperation of that. And it just – there's like I follow the Premier League really closely. I'm a Liverpool supporter, so I'm having a great time at the moment.
Yeah.
But there's a thing that Liverpool supporters say sometimes, and it's to do with all the mythology of their time in European competition especially. We're just so many great nights. And they just say, we've seen things you will never see. and I feel like that captures the uniqueness of being a Liverpool supporter. And I actually think Richmond and Liverpool are the same club, just separated by a hemisphere. But I feel like we can say that about that moment. We've seen things you will never see.
That's true. Yeah. And set up by the period of, the 37 years. Now, we're very keen to ask you about the book, but you just, that article in The Age, it's a fantastic piece, and it sets up, and people should read it. We don't need to go through it now. But do you ever pinch yourself that this team of lovable losers, this team of Matthew Richardson winning the Dreamtime and then having it taken away from us?
Matthew Richardson won one final in his career.
Yep, I was at that game. I remember. That was just like a few days after September 11 too.
Yeah.
That's right. Ray Hall kicked a magnificent goal.
Yes, he did. The boy from Woi Woi.
Yes. You talked about did you ever in your wildest dreams think that not only Richmond would be a dynasty, but a dynasty that's just so amazingly well coached and organised? You know, it's not just done on talent.
No, is the answer. Did you?
Of course not.
Yeah.
No.
Like, it still feels to me like we're talking about someone else. Like I do feel an affinity for this team, and I feel an ownership of it as a Richmond fan. But there's still a part of me that doesn't quite believe it. I think because when you have, you know, 35 years between grand finals, and in my lifetime only two finals appearances, really, in my football supporting lifetime. Like, you know, we won 1980 when I was two, but I have no memory of it. So, you know, when you've been through that, what I've learned from this, I don't know if you guys are the same, but that penetrates so deeply into your bones that it doesn't get changed by winning a flag or two or three. I know other people might think that we're a superpower, and in any objective sense, we are. But for me, we're still that club that, like, my head has been kicked repeatedly for 35 years, and I don't suddenly not have a headache anymore.
Did you secretly enjoy it when we went to Port Adelaide for the final, and we weren't getting the positive media like we used to not get, and Tom Lynch is the villain? You know, it was like almost like the old days. No one gave us a shot. Like, part of me really enjoyed that, being the underdog again.
Yeah, I did actually. And do you know what? I succumbed. Like, I didn't give us a chance, because my theory was we'd never beaten a good team in Adelaide, actually. Like, when you look at it,
that's true.
We'd won games there, but we'd never beaten a good team there. Certainly not in a game that really mattered. And
certainly not in the final.
No, well, I was at that 2014 elimination final. I can tell you we didn't win that day. So I've never seen a game end quicker. That was real. Wow, that was amazing. So I didn't really give us a shot, which kind of released the shackles a bit for me. But I think what was great about it, and I think what was great about the whole 2020 Premiership, was it's just, it answers every qualification that people have wanted to throw at Richmond's two premierships to that point. You know what I mean? It's like,
absolutely.
You've actually had an easy run in the finals. You've had a couple of soft kills in grand finals, etc. Oh yeah, okay. Well, what about this? You had the MCG. What about this?
If you looked at percentage at the end of the home and away season this year, Geelong and Port Adelaide were the two teams, and we beat them both, and we beat them on Port on their home deck.
Yes, and we beat both of those teams at their own game. Beat them at stoppages when we've been a bad team at stoppage.
I loved your plus 30 in centre square stoppages, the best in finals history.
As far as that record's been taken, we're up plus 30 for the final series. No one has done that before. And we're a bad stoppage team. So it tells you about how good this team, like how well coached they are. And we overlook it because we compare it to the other dynasties and we might say, you know, football supporters would say something like, well, Jason Castagna's not getting a game for Hawthorn or Geelong or Brisbane. And maybe that's right. But I think there's a real question as to whether or not some of even those stars might fit into this Richmond team. Like it's actually a very well composed whole, this one.
I love people saying that. I love that argument that, that's what you'd rather be, a team of people who work really hard for each other than a team of stars.
And have specific talents that are being maximized.
Yeah. And both having the team structure and having the stars, I think. having Dusty turn into a Greek god of flame every time the final starts.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. The other thing about that Port Adelaide game, though, too, is in some ways I felt like, in hindsight, that we actually needed it. I feel like the one thing I would say about this team is that, apart from maybe 2018, they've never given us that feeling that Geelong fans or Hawthorn fans, I think particularly, had during their dynasties, which is just this feeling that it is inevitable we will beat you. I don't feel like we've had that, because especially in the last, like 2017 was obviously a miracle year. 2018, we did have that. Like week to week, I just went going, wow, we are so far and away the best team. We will just win. But then 2019, we have that injury crisis and we work ourselves into a position where we have to win every game in order to win the grand final. And then we just do it. And then this year, it's a similar sort of thing, right? So we haven't had that. You know, I think one of the reasons people might not rate the Richmond dynasty at the same level is that we don't have that just week in, week out dominance where we'll just, okay, give us your best and we'll beat you by 100 points. We don't really have that. But it's not just that we flick the switch at the right time. I think what happens is this is a team that needs an obstacle. So it needs to be backed into a corner where the footy world and maybe even some people in the club are thinking, we don't think you can do this. And then they show that they can overcome pretty much whatever's thrown at them. It's remarkable. I don't know that there are that many teams who are like that.
No, it's been a wonderful ride. Now, a key part of that wonderful ride is Basher Hawley.
Yes.
And you've co-authored a fantastic, I actually tried to buy it today. I haven't yet, but I've read some of the stories from it already. Yeah. He's such an emblematic and amazing, interesting character. Why now? What's been the impetus to put this story in writing now?
So to be honest, the impetus isn't mine. So this happened start of last year, I reckon. I have a meeting with him and his manager, and they say, and Bash basically says to me, and I've known Bash since before he got drafted into the AFL, like just before, it's the first time I met him. So, you know, it's not out of the blue that we would, you know, have a chat or anything. But he said, look, here's what I want to do. I want to release a book, and there is no one else who can write it except you. And
what do you say to that?
Yeah. And the problem was, and I understand this may sound arrogant, I don't mean it that way, but the problem was I knew he was right in that I knew what he wanted. And he did explain it, but I knew it immediately. Because what all that he really wants, I think, is to represent himself and his faith to the audience that is watching. That's all he, like, he cares more about that, I think, than he does about just about anything else. And, you know, there are amazing football journalists, but can you imagine any of those football journalists trying to come to terms with explaining Islamic concepts that are really important to him that have shaped the way he's responded to certain situations or whatever? Like, it would just be a bridge too far. It would be ridiculous to ask that of them. It just wouldn't be fair. And so, you know, when you line it all up and he sort of says, well, you'll understand all the Islamic stuff. You'll understand the cultural background and all of that sort of stuff. You're a Richmond fan. You understand the footy. Like, there's no one else that can do this. I kind of didn't have a way of saying, yeah, you'll be fine, find someone else. I kind of felt there's an obligation here. I'm, you know, for better and or probably for worse, I'm best placed for this. And I can see that this really matters to you. So that's how it happened. The question really is, what was the impetus for him? And I think the impetus for him is, if you look at through his career, I mean, there's various stages of it, you know, establishing himself as a player, falling out of favour at Essendon, going to Richmond, then re-establishing his career until ultimately it prospers, and then, you know, premierships and so on. But along the way, the things that he really cared about, you know, establishing the Bashahuli Academy originally, which was a way of getting young Muslim footballers, you know, to develop in the game rather than just have a loose affinity for it, but kind of to get them introduced to elite training and those sorts of things, creating the Bashahuli Cup, like a Islamic school inter-school football competition, because that's the one thing he never had, right? He went to an Islamic school. He never got to play inter-school sport, right? Which, when you think about it, in the context of the AFL, where everyone's coming from like Assumption or Marcelin or Xavier or whatever, and they're playing high-level inter-school football, that's a big gap, right? And he sees that gap and he wants to fill that gap. And then ultimately that becomes the Bashahuli Foundation, which runs all kinds of things, you know, leadership programs, employment stuff, like just a whole lot of things. He's a guy who sees, I think anyway, his career as something with a much broader purpose than, you know, kicks, marks, handballs and premierships. Like, he sees himself as owing things to his community and having a responsibility to communicate his Islam to the broader audience, like to the broader football community. And I think he takes that really, really seriously. I write a foreword in it, and at the start of it, I tell this story about how his first week at Essendon, so he's not played a game, he's probably just been to two training sessions, he's in a school giving a speech as an Essendon player, right? Like, this is a kid who's what is he, 18 at the time? He could be forgiven for just thinking about nothing but how the hell am I going to get through the next training session? And he's doing community work.
Yeah.
Like, that, it's that ingrained in him, I think. And so for him, and it sort of became clear to me as I spoke to him more doing the book, was that this was for him, in a way, the last piece. Like, he cares about his legacy, and the Bashahuli Foundation is a really important part of that, especially for the Muslim community in that context. But he cares about his legacy, and I think the book was for him a kind of statement, a kind of way of expressing who he was in a way that would last beyond his career. So I gather that really that's the impetus.
Well, Ed, the other aspect to you writing the story is you having followed the story for nearly 15 years. And I think an interesting aspect is that you say about him having fallen out of favour at Essendon. He comes to Richmond as a delisted 22-year-old who's played 5 games for the 14th-ranked club. Like, all of... You know, you can't use football as a platform if you're just another obscure footballer who's washed out in his early 20s. And I think that's an incredible sliding door moment of that where we are now seems incredible for where we were then.
Yeah, it really does. And it's interesting talking to him about that period at Essendon. Like, I think he really struggled with it for obvious professional reasons. I think part of it was also a grievance that he didn't know what he'd done wrong or what, like he was dominating in the VFL and there were other players at Essendon that were like, you've got to pick this kid. And they just weren't. And he watched other players who weren't playing as well get games ahead of him. It was just that maddening situation. I'm sure you can imagine where you just, there are no answers and there seems to be no way out and doesn't seem to be any reason to it. But what's interesting talking to him about that period is I really, anyway, got the sense that it weighed very heavily on him because he felt he'd let a community down. Mm. He'd go to the congregational prayers that happen at the mosque on a Friday or whatever, and people would ask him, oh, have you retired or whatever? And that would really hit him hard, right? And he would recognize, like, you know, these are people who don't understand how hard it is even just to play one game, like to get to the point where you play one AFL game. But that wasn't enough consolation, really. Like it hurt him. And he'd hear whispers around the community that people thought, oh, he's not really that good or whatever. And it hurt him. But it might have hurt his pride a little bit, but I get the sense with Bash that wasn't the main thing. That it's really this sense that he had a job to do and he was not able to do it. But that's why he establishes the academy. That's why he does all that sort of stuff. Because once he gets to Richmond and his career starts looking up, and I think the academy happens once he gets to Richmond, actually, if I'm remembering the chronology correctly, you can see this is a person who's right. All right, I know what my purpose is and I'm working towards it. And in the book, something people probably wouldn't know is he got very close to retiring end of 2016. And one of the reasons he kept going was that he felt there was work to do with the foundation and that he would achieve a lot more in that way and in all other ways as a player. So he's always had, I think, that sense that he's doing it for other people, and he's carried that with him since before he was drafted.
In Conrad's piece, you mentioned about I'm not a competitive person, and I sort of looked funny at that. Like, I thought, how do you play elite sport if you're not a competitive person? Like,
yeah.
He's a fantastic athlete, but surely, and he's just played a grand final with a torn calf that the rest of us would have put our hands up and needed a stretcher to get off the ground, and he's played three quarters of gut-busting football. Like, surely there's white line fever there to some extent.
Yeah, so I'm with you. I can't imagine it, but I'm certain he's not being dishonest. He just has this other source of motivation, and he's capable of seeing a bigger picture and a broader perspective on football even as he's playing it, I think.
Wow.
Which is remarkable. I mean, he told me there's some stories that didn't make it into the book just because, you know, I couldn't figure out a way to get them in, and they weren't, you know, especially big. But just even little things like the conversations he would have. Do you remember last year in the grand final, there was this moment where he and Toby Green had a chat?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so there was that moment, and then the week before a similar thing happened with Grian Myers, which I don't think got any attention. With Grian Myers, I think it sledged him.
Oh, and Mark Latham said he should have been suspended.
Oh, right, okay. Well, that was for that bump that wasn't really a bump, yeah. But no, I think this was earlier in the game. I think maybe Geelong had kicked a goal or whatever and Grian Myers sledged him and said something about, you know, well, you've got next week off or something like that. And then, of course, Richard win and whatever. Anyway, the common theme between the conversation he has with Grian Myers and the conversation he has with Toby Green is that his default seems to be to kind of talk about it in terms of character. So he doesn't sledge back by, you know, stick that up here, whatever. Like, it's not that kind of response. He responds by saying, why do you have to do that? Like, it's not, you know, you're actually a good guy. Like, there's no need for this. Like, you don't have, this is just kind of needless. We can just it's fine. We'll just get on. We'll play. Everything will be all right. Like, you know, it's that kind of, like, obviously I'm paraphrasing, but it's that kind of tone to his whole thing. I think that is how he approaches stuff.
That must be quite disarming.
Well, I've never been on the receiving end as an opposition player, but I imagine it would be, right? Like, what do you say back?
I mean, Josh Caddy had a lot to say to Myers in that same game. I'm pretty sure he said something very similar along the same lines.
Yeah, I get the feeling Cads would have done that. Yeah. Yeah. But so, and you get the sense that Grian Myers and Toby Green are probably similar in that respect. Like, they're antagonists. They like to play that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a football fan, I don't have a problem with that. But it's interesting that the way Bash responds to that.
And there's a certain protocol to how those conversations go. And it sounds like Bash is just completely bypassing that.
Yeah, I think that's what happens, right? So he just comes at things from a totally different place. And, you know, part of that's just his natural disposition, I think, but his character. But I think religion's plays a major role in that. Because that's how he cultivates his character. I think he's quite keen to make sure that whatever the circumstances, he's not surrendering his character to the situation, right? He's not subordinating that to the desperation of winning or whatever it might be. But also, I imagine this wouldn't work for a lot of people. I think he's got a kind of personality where the less important it is, the better he plays. Like, the freer he feels. So he sort of would talk to me, he would describe himself as not caring about footy, which is why he plays well. And I said, it's not really that you don't care. That doesn't really make sense. It's more that you're carefree in the way that you play. And when that happens, it works. And in some ways, that's what happened at Richmond in 2017, right? They went from being a club that just worried about everything to a club that worried about nothing.
And yet he has a massive career year in 2019 and makes All Australian and averages 4 more disposals than he ever has before at an age when most players are retired.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's an incredible career.
Yeah, but you know what's actually fascinating though about that? And there's a chapter on a lot of this. I think there's a chapter on, it might be in the chapter on success. But he's interesting in the way he talks about once he sort of realized how good a season he was having, it started to distract him. Sorry about that. So he found himself, you know, looking up, Kane Corn's team of the week or whatever to see if he was in it and stuff like that, which is not him, right? He
should never look at anything Kane Corn, right?
Actually, it might not have been Kane Corn, it might have been Campbell Browns, but either way, same idea, right? So but he found himself getting caught up in this question of, will he make All Australian, will he not? And his solution to all of that is something that I think comes from his faith, but also came from conversations he'd had with Justin Lepich, who was his line coach at Richmond, where is basically just take the focus off yourself and direct it elsewhere. So Lepich sort of said, get out of your own head, go watch video with Derek Egmalesi-Smith and help him understand the role that you play, that sort of thing. And I think he does use that as a way of sort of getting it. He wants to take the focus off himself, not just when he's talking to people, but I think within his own mind, because he knows that that's when he starts to get in his own head and gets into a bit of trouble. So it's fascinating like that. I feel like a lot of the things that move him are probably different to the things that move a lot of other players, even down to the fact that he's quite insecure in some ways. So he... you know, in the book, he talks about how he doesn't respond well to criticism. It takes him a long time to sort of take it in and then act constructively with it. So Hardwick won't yell at him. He responds well to being told, to being given confidence. And he says he's the exact opposite of Jack Riewoldt. So Hardwick will just yell at Riewoldt all the time because that gets the best out of Jack. Right? Bash is not like that.
Well, Speaking of which, I think sort of looping the conversation to where we started, like the one of my first memories was actually as a child at the MCG getting really emotional for Jimmy Jess's farewell game, because he was I think the one of two people or maybe three left from a premiership team. Like we seemed a million miles away from having premiership heroes anymore. And we're suddenly going to have three-time premiership players retiring in the next year or two. And yeah, that's going to be quite an emotional moment.
Yeah. Well, we've got 14 triple premiership players now.
Mm.
And then maybe next year, 14 four-time premiership players, who knows? Yeah, it will be. But do you know what? I think I know what you mean with Jess, because I had a similar sort of thing with like Barry Rawlings.
Mm.
But I never saw them win the premiership. I just knew they had.
Exactly.
So maybe it was so emotional, or that, you know, you felt it when they left, because that was the last connection you had to the idea of Richmond being a good team. Like that, there was nothing left. So I remember Jim Jess, but I only remember him in terrible teams.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, you know, let's say it's Bash or it's Jack Riewoldt or, you know, whoever is in that sort of 30-plus bracket. If they're the first to retire, don't you reckon there'll be a part of it where you go, wow, look at the other 13 triple premiership players that are still running around?
And there's a bit of – there's another bit to it is, you know, when Jim Jess retired, just for example, I remember it's sad because it was in some ways the end of an era which he never got to see. Whereas these guys, when Basher retires, like he's rung every bit of football and winning and grand finals that he could possibly – on any reasonable probability have expected from his natural ability. Like these guys are going out with just amazing CVs. Now – Waleed, you've been so generous with your time, and thank you. Now, I'm looking on the online options to buy the book, and I see they're volumeless, including you can get it as an Audible book, I can see.
Oh, is that right? Oh, good. Excellent. I hope whoever read it went okay with some of the Arabic pronunciations. I didn't read it, so
could you bear to read it?
Do you know what? I actually would have happily read it if, because I actually remember because they spoke to me about doing it, and the problem was you had to do it at certain times, and I've got a full time job where I have to be in a studio at a certain time. It just couldn't happen. But yeah, I think I could have. I say that not having to do it, because of course, famously with these things, you get in there and it takes you 3 hours to record a sentence, because every time you say anything, they hear something that needs to be corrected. So I don't know. But let me just say I'm glad somebody else has done it, but I could have if I had to, yeah.
And where's the best place for people to get to buy the book?
So I have been told by a lot of people they've seen it in their local bookshop. So I gather it's actually out really widely. So I think what you meant to say is all good bookstores. I think that's the official line. It's probably now that, true.
Now that people can go to them again.
Yeah, that's right. You don't even have to click and collect anymore. You can just go in and do it. There's a bookshop on Swan Street in Richmond called Avenue Books, which always seems to have a conspicuous amount of Richmond books, which is, I think, good given the location. It's definitely there. I know that because my wife specifically saw it. It'll be all over the place. So I hope you enjoy it if you do get a chance to read it.
I'm going to buy my copy in readings on Lygon Street and read it prominently with the cover facing upwards in Kiamo or somewhere like that. So.
please talk to me about my football club.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good thing to do. Or maybe just somewhere in Collingwood might be nice. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a better idea. Yeah, I like that. It's a mystery. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a fascinating interview. We've gone well over time, but we're really grateful, and I hope people get a chance to appreciate the book about someone who's an amazing Australian.
Well, no, thanks for having me, and sorry for banging on.
This is a place where you don't have to apologise for banging on about how awesome.
Oh, great! In that case, and another thing. No, I'll leave you alone.
All right, well.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
So thanks again to Wally Daly. His book, one of, I think it's three Richmond books coming out for the holidays, Faith, Football, and Family. Yeah, and we asked him for 10 to 15 minutes of his time, and he gave us close to an hour. So thanks again.
Yeah, he was fantastic, wasn't he? And, you know, you can tell the difference between someone who does media for a living and people like us who just do it on podcasts, on amateur podcasts. But he's an absolutely delightful man. And, yeah, I really enjoyed that. I can't wait to read the book, actually.
if you think, I was trying to work out. So we went, we had Dale Waitman's book about Dale Waitman in the early 90s, I think. And then, I mean, I can't think of another, like, serious book about Richmond until, you know, Martin Flanagan does his Richo book. Like, it's like 20 years with one book. And then, you know, we've got Conn's books, George Megalogenis's books, Wally Dully's book, the new Marlon Pickett book. Oh, it's a great time to be alive.
It is indeed.
I'm Nick.
I'm Andy.
We're Richmond Tiger Talk.
The Tigers are premiers for the 12th time in their history. Rioli, this time, 4-3-2-1, it's a goal, one of the Tigers. Whoa, what about that? A 4-3-60 in slow motion, just down the arms.
Oh, gee, yes. He's had four shots on goal. His worst. Big Mahan takes the mark. It was all too much for Leon. Well, he's an accurate set shot, the big fella. Four out of five so far this year. Make it five out of six. The skipper goes and goes and then tries to lace it out, but no, he doesn't. He kicks a goal. How sweet it is, eh? Pickett lines up.
Everywhere at the moment. Pickett's having an influence in his first game of footy.
Started with him.
Yep. Dusty's dangerous. The swarming pressure is overwhelming.
Didn't want the body contact. He kept the body free. The pickup's unbelievable. That's a play of the game. That is a play of the game.
We underestimate the footy brain in Dustin Martin. You look at his physical ability. Champion data would tell us 7 out of the last 9 finals you can make the case for being best on ground.
I think they were a better team last year than they are now.